Welcome, everybody, to the next episode of Our Memphis History. This episode is going to revolve around World War II, the civil defense in Memphis, and Cold War back in the 60s. We've got a distinguished panel here today. We are recording at the Memphis Room of the Public Library. And I'm going to go around and let them introduce themselves in just a minute here. First, we have Tim Curtis. We also have Robert Latham, Clint Buchanan, Claude Talford, and, of course, Joe Lowry's here. This is Mark White. So let's get started. Tim, if you give us a little bit of your bio, and then we'll kind of go around the room. We'll get started.
Well, good evening. I appreciate being invited. My name's Tim Curtis. I'm a certified emergency manager. I have been involved in civil defense since before I graduated high school. I started out as a disaster volunteer and worked my way up to become the Deputy Director of Emergency Services for DeSoto County, Mississippi, and I retired in 2014.
Oh, great. Thank you. It's great. Great to have you here.
Yes.
Robert?
My name is Robert Latham. I'm most recently the retired State Director of Emergency Management for the state of Mississippi, where I served for 10 and a half years working for three governors and went through Hurricane Katrina. Prior to that, spent 27 years in the Mississippi Army National Guard, retired. Also served in the fire service, where I retired as a chief at Centennial Fire Department, just south of here. Served as a county fire coordinator, and eventually the county emergency management director for Tate County, which again is just south of Memphis.
Thank you. Claude?
Good evening. My name is Claude Talford. I spent 25 years with the Memphis Fire Department. I retired from there. I moved on to the Memphis Shelby County Emergency Management Agency as the director there. And after leaving there, I went on to become the director of the newly formed director of the Lakeland Emergency Management Agency. Basically, I've spent, I guess, a little over 32 years in the fire service and emergency management. Such incidents I worked was, I was part of the Tennessee Task Force 1, went to the Pentagon, and also Hurricane Katrina happened during my administration as emergency management director for Memphis and Shelby County.
Thanks. Thank you for being here. Clint?
Clint Buchanan, Reed. Joined the Memphis Fire Department in 1969, stayed there until 1998, was promoted to chief of the paramedics during my tenure there, was promoted to director of EMA in 1998, and I retired in 2004 as a mixed combo of EMA director and Homeland Security director for Memphis and Shelby County. And I guess our biggest event during my tenure as EMA director was the 2003 Elvis Presley hurricane, or straight line winds, and enjoyed my time with the city. I spent 35 years with the city of Memphis.
Thank you.
I'm going to start this off and start talking about what Memphis did during World War II. We didn't really start doing anything until about June or July, and Mayor Chandler realized that and he had gotten a lot of information from the federal government that Memphis was such a strategic position with our bridges, with all the transportation hub that we had here, all of the works, and if y'all know that we had like two or three ammunition plants here. We had the Cordova powder plant. We had the Millington powder plant. We had several other facilities that were all involved in the war effort, including transportation. We knew that we had to do something, we had to put something in place, and so they sat down and with the federal government, they figured out that we needed an air raid warden program. We knew that the fire service was going to be taxed. We knew that law enforcement was going to be taxed. We also knew that we had to defend our bridges, so squads of police were assigned to go. 20 officers, in fact, were assigned to protect the bridges 24 hours a day in all kinds of weather. They even built a little house at the east side for the officers to be in, and the state of Arkansas provided police officers and law enforcement to take care of the west side of the bridge. It was a pretty big deal. One of the things that I found was quite interesting was in the federal emergency management planning at the time, they had taxed the Boy Scouts with messenger service. Now, think about that today. Messenger service. These were going to be Boy Scouts that were on bicycles delivering messages in town if we had been under attack. That to me is just, that boggles my mind. Walter Chandler got with Will Hale, who was over the county, and they formed a group called the Civilian Defense Corps locally, which involved about 1,500 ex-servicemen. They went out in the community and they found people that had been in the military or that had retired from the police department or the fire department, or people they knew they could trust and depend on. The Red Cross taught everybody first aid. The FBI taught everybody terrorism. The fire department went out and taught everybody how to pump pumps and man hoses and everything. And of course, at that time, the Memphis Fire Department had a long time back in when Irby Clint came over as fire chief in 1934. Started teaching all of the industrial plants. All of, we had 250 industrial plants that had industrial fire brigades. So we had people actually trained, so they knew that they would bring them in. The state set mandates, and one of the mandates was that they wanted to have observation posts. So I'm not exactly sure what they were looking for. I didn't know if they were going to look for enemy bombers, but all throughout the state of Tennessee, there were observation posts every 30 miles. I have not been able to find any data on that, but that was part of the deal. And each block, every block in the city of Memphis had an air raid warden. Every one of them had a fire warden. This was a big deal. The city went to no expense to create whatever they needed to do in order to protect citizens. Also during World War II, companies that had normally been making different types of supplies, we had a Fisher body plant here in town, they started making aircraft frames for bombers because we were the hardwood capital of the world. And so airplane wings and body frames were made here. It was either the first or the second largest general hospital with Kennedy Veterans Hospital. It was either first, the biggest or the second biggest veterans hospital in the United States was here. We also had two large depots. We had the Mallory Air Force Depot, which was basically Jackson on the south, Bayless on the east, Farmville on the west, and the railroad tracks. Elvin Tracks and Chelsea on the north. And then, of course, they took a man's farm and created the Army Depot down on Airways with Gunn on the north and Perry on the south. And what's the street in the rear?
Ball.
Yeah. And that's like, I can't remember how many acres that is, but it was either the first or the second largest inland supply base in the world was here. And they were able to do that because they had the airport here. We had five major railroads that came in and out of here. We had the bridges. We could move stuff out of Memphis, Tennessee. And this what we're thinking about now will carry over into the Cold War. When we start talking about that, we'll bring back and talk about what kind of a critical facility this whole area was and how vulnerable we were at the time.
So you mentioned the Veterans Hospital. Is that the one down on Jefferson, or was there one prior to that somewhere?
Well, they actually started. That's an interesting story because they were building it for one hospital. They ended up putting the Veterans Hospital down at Crump, 1025 East E.H. Crump. And then they kind of outgrew that and had to go out to get well. Which actually was
by the University of Memphis.
Yeah. Which actually used to be called, what was the name of the street?
Shotwell.
Well, it was Shotwell, and it was named for the Shotwell family.
Right.
The Shotwell family actually owned property. All of those streets that are north of Park, west of Goodland, south of Southern, east of Highland were all named after families. And that was the Shotwell.
Right. And they changed it because of the and to get well, which sounds much better for a hospital name than Shotwell.
When the civil defense started, And it wasn't as bad in Memphis as it was in cities that were like out in California,
yeah.
because, you know, they were, the Japanese were, yeah. were doing all kinds of naughty things. They had sent yeah. over devices that would travel with the wind, and when they got to a certain altitude, supposedly drop some type of pyrotechnic device. There had been reports of submarines actually in the harbor around New Jersey, and so the East Coast was, they were doing other things in fact, the federal government even allocated money to cities, and there's a breakdown on how this came about. Was if you had X number of fire engines in service, for every fire engine you had that was like over 15 years old, you got to get an auxiliary fire engine, which had a 500-gallon pump, or you were able to get an auxiliary trailer to supplement and augment your fire equipment. And so, you know, that started a precedence too,
yeah.
because in the 50s when we started to get into the Cold War, that's when they came out with that Calamity Jane series rescue truck. I've got the data. We'll cover that when we get into that section. So
in the early 50s, there was the whole thinking that it couldn't happen here. And so kind of why civil defense was started was that there was a conversation, an Air Force chief of staff had said that if even we knocked down a bunch of the Russian planes, it still, some of them would get through. So we still needed civil defense. It wasn't, we could just handle all of it and everybody could just go to sleep. It was not that type of situation.
We knew that we were never going to be able to stop them all.
Any other thoughts about civil defense back in the early 50s?
Well, you know, the comparison of back in the 60s and back during that period when you talked about the military, former military personnel being used as volunteers, you know, after 9/11, I thought it was just kind of strange that we asked the citizens of this country to become volunteers doing through the Citizen Corps program, but we didn't make that commitment to provide them with the necessary tools to be volunteers. I mean, you know, you create the Citizen Corps and insert training, but you know, once they get the training, they were pretty much on their own to provide the necessary tools and equipment that they were going to need. And that was a big difference between then and now. I think that there was a better commitment, even though the commitment wasn't as great as it should have been then, it was even less, in this modern day and time.
Yeah,
so back in the 50s and 60s, they were given some training there, and then it's gone. It's less and less now. Okay.
Yeah, I think to that point, I think one of the things that's really interesting is that we were pretty successful in the 50s and 60s, or the government was, in being able to mobilize the country in a way that where the citizens had the buy-in to be able to set up these community organizations and to support them. It is kind of interesting because when you look in a post 9/11 environment, when the government, which is becoming more and more reactionary and don't put a lot of thought into where they're going when they do something, a lot of money was provided, you know, to develop the CERT, enhance the CERT program, the Citizens Corps, and we gained a little momentum with that, and then the money dried up, and, you know, only those really programs where you have that citizen buy-in and there's still a need, you still have some fragments or pieces of those organizations left, but by and large, I think most of them have dried up. We don't have that
right.
anymore. And it seems to be that as long as there's money tied to it, we can mobilize people to do it, but if there's no money tied to it, I'm sorry, we just can't do it,
yeah.
and that's unfortunate.
Right.
I think rolling back and forth to the 60s and 9/11, as Claude was saying, we started a real heavy-duty CERT training program in Shelby County and down in DeSoto County as well. And a lot of people really showed a lot of interest.
Mm-hmm.
We got into the school systems. We got to the school teachers. They were giving some type of minimal training to the students to say, do this, do that, if this happens. And I think there was a lot of progress going on with the CERT program. And again, like he just said, when the money dried up, people quit. and they weren't being paid to begin with.
Sure.
It was just a volunteer program. But I know when I was over at EMA prior to my retiring, we were having a CERT program about every week, if not every 2 weeks. We had 20, 30 people in our office training in the CERT program. And there was probably, I'd say, in the thousands over that, when Claude took over, and from the time I went in there and CERT program started, there were thousands of people trained. I mean, thousands in Memphis and Shelby County.
We had a fairly nice cadre of instructors.
Yeah.
Joe would come down to DeSoto County and help me put on classes. Mm-hmm. I would come to Memphis and help put on classes up here. And we trained thousands of people.
Yeah.
But then it got to the point that, you know, the supplies are expensive.
Though.
And as long as we were able to keep them in fresh supplies, it was okay. But then once it started becoming a burden to the individual's pocket, then they just kind of dried up.
Well, it seems like it would be.
What drove that, though, was the earthquake.
Yes.
The driving force behind that really wasn't a terrorism event. It was that, you know, we live on a fault line and help's not coming and you're going to be on your own and the cops aren't coming and the fire engine's not coming, the ambulance is not coming. And
And that's the really unique thing about it, because after the big earthquake scare with Ivan Browning and the forecast on the New Madrid, we got out and we really started pushing the CERT program. And then after 9/11, when the feds came out with, hey, let's start this CERT program and let's start this Citizens Corps program, well, DeSoto County and Shelby County already had a good base of volunteers, so we were able to immediately jump into the Citizens Corps program, and we were ahead here in the Mid-South. We were ahead of the rest of the nation as far as Citizens Corps.
Well, and it seems like an event would cause that to spike up, and you'd have some residuals after that, and then it would kind of calm back down. So, such a normal.
It's on a wave.
Yeah, right.
I think, like I said, on that wave up and down, my concern was we were giving, you know, all these people the training, but we were not providing them actual CERT bag or CERT response bag. We were leaving it up to the individual. We trained you, but you got to go out and spend your money to get that bag and get what you need to be part of that CERT team or that neighborhood CERT team. My concern was there was not enough local buy-in from the local government,
right,
to help supplement that federal funding. We were getting federal funding, of course, to provide some of that training and buy the equipment to do the training, but there still was not that local buy-in.
Yeah.
That was always an issue with me.
Sure.
We depended on the federal government to give us so much, but when it came down to spending local dollars to help further the training, the supplying of volunteers, never got that back, and that was always a great sore spot with me.
Sure, right.
And I think the other thing was that early on after 9/11, you know, the funding that was provided, you know, was billions of dollars to buy a lot of equipment. The problem is none of the money could be spent on planning.
Mm.
So you could go out and buy a bunch of stuff, but you didn't know exactly how you were going to use it. And so one of the fears was, and it came true, was we bought a lot of stuff with a shelf life, like double A suits and that type of stuff, that eventually, you know, lost its shelf life and then could be used for training, but not in real life events. And we also partitioned that money off, for the federal government did, and said you can't spend that money on anything but terrorism equipment. You know, as opposed to approaching it from an all hazards standard,
sure,
we said only. And eventually, that changed, but we wasted a lot of money early on that could have been invested much more wisely,
right,
and we could have sustained probably a more all hazards approach to response a lot longer than we've been able to do had the money been stressed out with all hazards intent.
Sure, having a good plan before you go start buying stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Sense everywhere.
Yeah, some of the money when I was over there, we got a $30 million check from the government when, right after 9/11, mm-hmm, and we were told basically you could do A, B, and C with it. But one of the things that we weren't spending enough on was training. Yeah. We were buying toys. I mean, buying equipment, and everybody wanted their share.
Sure.
In Memphis and Shelby County, we had seven major people that wanted money. I mean, we got seven cities,
sure,
and everybody wanted their share. And then you had to go with the big boys like Memphis Police and Memphis Fire. The bigger got the bigger chunk of money, but.
Right.
You know, what I do want to say now, and I'll say it again later, is the CERT program that we were discussing, the training and the preparedness from the individuals in the neighborhoods is, you know, the people that are listening to this need to know that you need the training not only for terrorism, but for an earthquake or any other type. We could have another hurricane come through here, and you have to self-sustain for 2 to 3 days, and people need to get prepared. I think Joe's going to cover another issue that some people weren't given the opportunity to be trained years ago, and it's true. And nowadays, back at least when I was there in the 2000 era, we brought anybody that wanted to come in there and gave them training. There was no cost to them. And like Claude said a minute ago, we didn't send them home with anything.
Sure.
You know, just we have a neighborhood group that comes in, we train them. There's 40 people in that subdivision that are interested, and we say thank you and send you home. But the team captain didn't go home with a bag. He didn't go home with gauze and Band-Aids.
Right.
And I think that was a shortcoming on our part. When, if we'd written the grant properly, we would have had that funding to say, okay, team captain gets a ditty bag.
Sure. Our neighborhood association's gone through that because of Stornoway, and they came back with the knowledge, but that was really it.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's fine, but you're right. There has to be some follow-up and some practical application to that. So,
right.
And there are many things that could happen.
We have completed World War II, so now we're into the 50s. So what did we learn when we were talking about World War II? Well, the next thing that we are now dealing with is dealing with the Japanese attacking us and all that thing. We start to get into the Cold War.
And the Russians and the threat of nuclear war.
And the Russians and the threat. So how do we warn people? Well, we came up with a system called Conrad. You'll probably remember that. It was on your radio that you had what was it, 6? I think I had to write it down. I can't ever remember it. It was 6:40 and 12:40 on your AM dial. And what they would do, that you had designated Conrad stations. The way they determined that was, they determined that they would find out what radio or radio station or TV station had the best chance of being up on the air. It was not going to be Channel 13, because back in the day, any time the wind came through, Channel 13 went off the air. And that's historical fact. And so the Channel 5 had a better chance, so Channel 5 was for a long time, and then they moved it to Channel 3 with the designated Conrad agency for this area. What that meant is that at 10 o'clock in the morning, usually, or 2 in the afternoon, they would interrupt broadcasting and say, this is your Conrad station, and if it's been an emergency, you'd be tuned to, you know, told to tune there. Then we started having a thing. The federal government put out a program, and they called it Operation Alert. And Operation Alert was a national program. Cities had to buy into it. And at certain times of the year, I know one year it was in May, one year it was in June, one year it was in October, and that was a fiasco because it lined up with Fire Prevention Week, and so that didn't work. What they did was, in Memphis, one of the years, the Civil Air Patrol actually flew over the city of Memphis and dropped 10,000 leaflets out. They had blown the sirens. They had told everybody take cover, and everybody this gave them the right to install sirens. Memphis installed 17 motorized, had the big, look like a tuba up there, siren that would turn along with where they, there's a whole occult issue out there on sirens. There's people out there that have sirens today on their, when they crank their computer up, the siren light comes over them. But the sirens that we had were activated by the fire department, and when they activated the sirens, you were supposed to take cover. And if you did not take cover, and one of these leaflets fell down, the leaflets actually had on them, "You are dead." They had to do something to get people's attention, because like with every disaster we've ever had in Memphis, it wanes off after a period of time, and you've got to have something. And every single year they did something different to try and keep people interested. And then they came up with all of these programs. Do you remember all the programs? Tim, you're an expert on this subject. So.
Well, one of the programs that they came up with was crisis relocation. The thought was that we would have enough time prior to the launch of the attack that we could load everybody up onto school buses, MATA buses, in their cars, whatever means of transportation that you could get, and they would go to the host counties. We found out really quick in Memphis and Shelby County that while in the eyes of the federal government, the host counties would receive you with open arms, the fact was two of the counties that adjoin us, one's in Mississippi, one's in Arkansas. So even if you could get that many cars across the bridge at one time, Arkansas did not want all these extra people, because Little Rock was also on the target list, so they were going to have to shelter their own people as well. So you ran into the situation of, what are you going to do with the people? I know that when I became involved in emergency management in 1981, the plan was still on the shelf there in DeSoto County. We were supposed to load every citizen in DeSoto County onto a school bus and take them to Lafayette County. The thought was that they would evacuate all the students out of Ole Miss and send those people home, and then the empty dorm rooms would be used to shelter the people from DeSoto County. And then the Memphis and Shelby County residents would go to Fayette County or to Tipton County.
Wow.
They'd be cheerfully accepted. This was the way it was written in the plan.
Yeah. Well, we see how well that works with hurricanes. You try and get everybody on one road going one way. It takes a little while to get that done. So I'm surprised that didn't, you know, the model there was for that. But
explain Bert the Turtle.
Bert the Turtle was a cartoon character that was developed by the Federal Office of Civilian Defense that was a public relations tool. Bert was designed to teach the school children the duck and cover. He had a nice little jingle, and as Bert would be walking along, he would see the flash of light, and he was supposed to immediately duck into his shelter, which was his shell, and then he would come back out after a specified time when everything was supposed to be okay. And for kids growing up in the 50s, 60s, and the first half of the 70s, you know, we were carried into the auditorium once a month, and we were shown videos. We got to watch Bert the Turtle, and the civil defense man would come in. And if you've ever seen the documentary "A Lady Called Camille," Wade Geiss is in the film, and he's wearing the classic white civil defense jumpsuit with the CD logo, and that would be what they would come to the schools wearing, and they would teach us to duck and cover when we saw the flash.
Well, we'll try and link to some of these videos and things that you're talking about in the show notes. So if you're listening to this, check out the show notes. We might have some of those videos.
YouTube.
Yeah, they're on YouTube. We'll get them for you.
One of the other things that happened. And, you know, the federal government's always looking for something to throw at it. In 1954, they came up, out with the heavy rescue and the light rescue. Set a standard, made about 110 of these things. Different communities could either purchase them for $1 a year. they were given to communities based on population and who they were going to serve. Memphis got two of them. We used one as a rescue. We used one as a salvage. When these trucks came out, they were on a 145 horsepower Rio, made by Gerson Slaughter and some of the other companies that made rescue bodies. But at the time, Memphis didn't own a Stokes stretcher. We didn't have one. We didn't have any vehicles. They had a winch. None of our vehicles had a winch. None of them had acetylene torch. None of them had any of the, which of the day, none of them had porta power. This was the class act in 1950, 52, 54. This had all of the most modern stuff on it, and various cities got them. Memphis, they came blue and white. Memphis had the agreement with the federal government was that we did not want it to be blue and white. We wanted it to be vermilion red with dark forest green, which was our running board color. And they said, you can change the color, but you can never color over the civil offense symbol. And so both of y'all were on the job. I was too. When we had those, we ran the stew out of those things. They had no air conditioning. You were cramped in there. Either one of you ever ride on those Rios?
I did.
Man, you know, they were
hot. I saw pictures.
They were hot in the summertime, and they were cold in the winter. And they weren't very fast, but they were the thing. And occasionally you'll still see them floating around different cities, used them for different things. When we're talking about educating the public, are we happy with the way you were educated pertaining to civil defense?
Well, let's specify that question. Were you happy with your civilian training? Because all of these guys have done the job. So
all of us here were the folks that were crawling under our desk when the flash of light came.
I can remember as a child. I mean, once a month, I believe we had assembly programs in school, and the entire student body would go into the auditorium or assembly hall or whatever they had to school. And they'd have different programs, but many times it was like Tim said, you'd have the local civil defense guy if you were fortunate enough to have one. If not, you'd look at a film that might start off with a nuclear explosion. I mean, so it was like a shock and bang kind of thing. You know, it gets your attention really, really quick, and it shows students getting under their desk and things like this. But you know, the interesting thing was that I can remember also that at our home, you know, I remember exactly what closet. It was in the closet in my mother and daddy's room. We had a closet of canned goods and stuff like that that we had stocked. I mean, so, you know, I'm not going to say that everybody did, but we probably did a better job then of mobilizing the public to get involved in the preparedness aspect and their responsibilities than we're able to do today. I just think that we've gotten in the mindset that either it's not going to happen or it's not going to affect me, and the chances are slim, or more likely that whatever happens, the government's going to take care of it, and I don't really have a responsibility, which is a sad commentary to our history. When you look at what we've been through, we learn it and we forget it very quickly.
Yeah. You know how many houses in Memphis have a bomb shelter? We did a little study when I worked at EMA, and there was a lot of people in the 60s that were scared so bad. One time we had about 1,500 homes in the city of Memphis where people would go in and dig a nice bomb shelter, but you couldn't talk about it to your friends. You couldn't let anybody know that you had it, because if you had a crisis, they're going to come over to your house, and they were coming in your bomb shelter whether you liked it or not. And think about this. There was a company over on Summer Avenue, just east of Highland, on the south side of the street, that was selling fallout shelters. And you could go over there and look at all these different fallout shelters. What they did not tell you, which we didn't know, was our water table was so high here that if you put that containerized in the ground, the water table would
float it up.
Just like a septic tank. When you put septic tank in, it's the same thing. And all these people that built these backyard bomb shelters, every one of them ended up being a snake-infested thing, because the water would seep in, and nobody could ever use it. And it's just like when we put that shelter program in place in Memphis. It was for occupants.
Yeah.
And a few residences. And they never told you that the occupant shelter was only designed to handle 54 people. No one ever told you that.
Yeah,
it was all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, I know that those of you that are from Memphis and worked in Memphis remember, but I remember the Commercial Appeal running an article on the one that was on Bellevue there in Whitehaven, which was
Mr.
under.
Williams.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a house underground, had a mortgage, it had everything. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, finally when they were able to talk about it, they did a special article on that and what all was in it. And I was just absolutely amazed at it.
The problem here is that we had never been fair in the way we trained everybody. The training we got in the white community was not the same training that the black community got.
Yeah, yeah.
And same way with shelters. There were shelters in the black community that were small and just a few, and then there was a whole lot in designated areas. So there's some issues with that.
Yeah.
When they put the shelter system in, there were no shelters in Germantown, Barlow, or Corryville, or Arlington, or in the county, for that matter. There was I'm not sure why there was one in either Ellendale or Eads, and may have had some official that lived out there. But the training for all was not fair in the 60s.
And you speak of the shelters. I remember the only few shelters that we had in our area. I grew up in South Memphis, of course, around Parkway and 3rd in that area. We had A.B. Hill Elementary School and Florida Elementary School. They had fallout shelter signs on them, but neither of those schools had basements in them.
Yeah.
You know, so they had the fallout shelter signs, but there were no basements in those schools. They had an opportunity, I guess the city had an opportunity to address that because they built Carver in like 1957. So there was an opportunity to build a basement to that school and create a neighborhood shelter, but they didn't do it. And of course, by the time the 70s rolled around, they also built Riverview Junior High, and it was pretty much a postmodern 70 building. I mean, barely no windows,
right,
but still no basement. You know, you know how you get those houses, you built on a hill, and you had you had the earth against one side of the building, so
yeah,
that was as close as a shelter as that school could have been, because it's on it. You know, it was kind of built into the side of the hill. But other than that,
we never had enough. In our history, we never had enough to take care of everybody and take care of everybody fairly. And it was always smoke and mirrors. And of course, nobody at the time realized it. We realize it now because we're all of us in this table are all students of our craft, and we've learned it because we've had to deal with the lives of people that we served as emergency managers. Back then, emergency management under civil defense was operated by the military. Our first civil defense director was a guy named Colonel Summers. He came in, had been ex-military guy. His deputy director had been a military guy. All of those had been military people up into the 60s.
I'm a lifelong Memphian. I've always heard that the reason we were so top of the list for any of this nuclear stuff to happen here was four different things. One was the Millington Air Base. One was the bridge system over the river, the medical center, and also the defense depot. And so, would y'all like to talk about that? Was that true? That was, we were on that list because of those things. That's three or four different things that are very large.
The Russians had three missiles aimed for this area. One of them was aimed for, they knew that they could never understand why we had such a big Navy base and didn't have any water. So that was one of the promoting things. Secondly, we had, you take out Memphis's transportation abilities, the ability to move products and services through rail and through water and by bridges, and then you take out all of the other infrastructure that goes along with it. We had a tremendous base of population here that were able to support our efforts, our hospitals and everything. If you were to take out this area, it crippled the whole country.
And that's still true today. I mean,
it's true.
You look at the threat of the New Madrid Fault. I mean, you look at the north, south, east, west transportation corridors, FedEx, and all of those. I mean, it would totally bring our logistics system in this country to a screeching halt.
Yeah, it's even worse. Even worse now. I think, like you said, FedEx is here now.
Yeah.
All of the hospitals are much, much bigger than they were back in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, yeah.
So this is an even bigger target. So
that, and we have the major pipelines that cross through Memphis and Shelby County that provides most of the heating oil to the northeast.
Yeah, I got two of those running through my backyard. I know exactly what you're talking about.
We have more pipelines in Shelby County than anywhere in three states.
So if anybody's sleeping really well at night, that'll help you with that.
Well, the thing is, and that's one thing we had to deal with during the Elvis Presley hurricane in 03, is that we had to make sure that the fire and the police had fuel. So one of our tasks was to make sure fuel was put away for the fire and police in case the crisis hit. The importance of fuel in Shelby County or the Mississippi River, you shut the bridges and you drop the bridges into the Mississippi River, you stop the barges. The barges bring fuel. We're putting out in the neighborhood of 8 million gallons of fuel a day out of Memphis. And 8 million gallons is a lot of gasoline, jet fuel, and that count the pipelines going to the airport. So you shut the river down, you shut Memphis, you shut DeSoto County, you shut some of Arkansas, and so on. It would take several days to get things back on track by rerouting things. So, yeah, that the hub of being the resource center for this area is probably way up here over the Navy base. And like Joe right. said, the Russians and other foreign countries, that probably North Korea and everyone else, always had a thought based on the information that we received when we were doing some homeland stuff, that something was very important in Millington, because they have a high-end thousands of acres of a Navy base with airplanes coming in and out of it and no water. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be important.
Something's going on. Yeah.
That was always a threat.
Always tried to look at things at the state level as if I were at the local level, because we have a tendency in government, the higher up we go, the less emphasis we put on the impact it has on at the lowest level of government or where the message. And I think that we have a tendency in government all the way from the federal government down to kind of drive things down as opposed to let things be pushed up. I mean, the closer you get to the people and the people who we all worked for and the people that we serve, the closer you are to them, the more I think you understand the impact of what we expect of them. And also, how do you motivate them to do things? And if it's done at the local level, you'll be much more successful than, say, from a state perspective or even the federal level.
I will agree with that. And I want to go back and say something that Claude touched on earlier. And emergency management agency is a sleeping dog as far as the citizens of, I'll speak of the citizens of Memphis, is concerned. They don't know who we are. They don't know or didn't know who we were. And even the government itself, local government, they don't fund it properly. I mean, it's probably one of the lowest budgets. I'm not looking for a fire police, you know, $175 million budget, but I'm looking for more than $2 million a year to protect the citizens of Memphis and then put training programs out there. And when I was director, I mean, that was one thing I fought, is trying to get money on the local level, not chasing the feds' money, which it comes and it goes. You need to have a budget that will sustain that agency and put it out front where the citizens of Memphis will understand we have a problem. In a disaster, there's going to be some serious problems, and it's going to take time to organize the chaos. It's going to be chaos. Then it goes to organized chaos, mm-hmm. and then back to normal. So funding is very relevant, very important to what probably needs to happen in Memphis and Shelby County toward the Emergency Management Agency for protection of the citizens.
Well said. All disasters begin at the local level, and they end at the local level, and the local government needs to step up and support their local emergency management programs. Unfortunately, throughout most of the country, you end up having to come up with some pretty interesting ways to finance your organization. Memphis, for years, provided all of the ambulance communications as a sideline to justify having dispatchers sitting in the basement of City Hall. We end up out in the rural areas, we have to be the fire coordinator, we have to be the EMS person, we have to be, in some cases, the animal control officer, because the funds are just not funneled into the position like it should be.
I've known, and you have too, the emergency management director in Marshall County was the fire investigator, the dog catcher, the emergency manager, the EMS director, the 911 director. How do you do that? How do you, that's your area.
Yeah, we all have had to do interesting things. You know, Robert comes from a multifaceted background in that he wore multiple hats when he was at the local level. Clint had to wear, and Claude had to wear multiple hats at the city and county level. You know, they were in a unique situation because they were a joint city-county operation. So, you know, they had two bosses to answer to. That's right.
Our biggest problem was the Bartlett mayor.
He learned the day that Hurricane Elvis came through, that brought everybody in the EOC, and we were all in there, and Mayor Wharton was in there, and Mayor McDonald hadn't been mayor very long, and he called in and he started demanding stuff, and I ended up talking to him. That was a bad, probably a bad thing. And I asked him, I said, Mayor, send me your damage assessment information. He said, what is that? I said, call Gary Graves, your fire chief. He knows what that is. When you send me your damage assessment information, then we'll know what toys to send you. And no offense to him, he was a new mayor at the time, didn't know.
You know, the interesting thing, and I've said this a lot more since I retired than wouldn't say it publicly when I was employed, but since regardless of what your background is, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or, you know, whatever, it's interesting in disasters because every disaster, the local guy wants the federal government to pay for it. They don't want to have any responsibility, certainly no financial responsibility or commitment. They don't have, rainy day funds. And even at the state level, we didn't do a rainy day fund for disasters. I mean, every time we had a major disaster and needed funds to match the federal dollars, they would have to do a special session and appropriate the money. So we didn't, we just didn't do a very good job and still don't. We just, which just says we'll deal with it when it happens. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think the local citizens don't realize that for every 300 plus citizens is probably one paramedic, double that, same with police officers and firefighters. So those people, to think that locally that, as we stated earlier, that help is going to be on the way from your local agencies is the pipe dream, so to speak. You know, you have to prepare yourself. The money has to be spent locally. That local buy-in from local politicians has never been there. It's still not there today. That's a frustration of mine that ebb and flow comes and they don't spend the necessary dollars to try to educate the public, to try to properly prepare the public for a major event. We are so reactionary. We, in this day and age, we should be able to plan accordingly for any disaster, all hazard type disasters, but local politicians will not do the proper funding of emergency management agencies and the training and equipment that they need. And I just find that still to be absurd in this day and time. You know, don't wait for it to happen, then now you got to try to, you lose all this loss of life and loss of property before you realize, well, hey, we need to do something.
Yeah. History repeats itself.
Yes, it does.
And we see it. We've seen it in our lifetime.
Yeah.
I see it all the time.
Well, we had a nuclear threat in the 50s, and we have nuclear threat today.
That's right. Yeah.
Full circle.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know we've talked quite a bit about CERT, and we'll put some links on the in the show notes to some sites there. And hopefully this podcast will help spread that word that we're not getting what we need. But I'll speak for myself, my family, and the listeners here. I appreciate everything that all four of you guys and five of you guys have done for the safety of Memphis. It's been a very important part of that, and I appreciate your time. This has been a great podcast, and I want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks.